This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Another week and another topic.
Yes.
This one probably not as pleasant as some, but it's a problem that is much more common than a lot of people think. But the people who have it certainly know about it and know it's a problem. It's urinary incontinence. Troubling, yes. Inconvenient, certainly. Sometimes embarrassing, absolutely. Well, why does it happen and who's at risk? Urinary incontinence.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with urologist and incontinence expert Dr. Dan Elliott. We'll find out if you have it, who you should go to see to get it evaluated. We'll talk about the different types of incontinence and why it matters. And we'll tell you about the latest and best treatment options, including new medications with fewer unpleasant side effects. Plus, we'll talk about the surgical options. It's possible that your incontinence could be cured with a simple outpatient procedure. But first, today is World Lupus Day. And the reason why we have these special observances for something like World Lupus Day is to spread a little bit of awareness about the disease of lupus.
You know, I'm sorry about that. My water bottle just had a little incontinence.
Yeah.
Got everything a little bit wet, but you survived it, and I survived it, and nobody got wet.
The wave of water. Let's see. Joining us is Mayo Clinic rheumatologist Dr. Vi Chowdhury. Good morning, Dr. Chowdhury.
Good morning.
Hello. What? First of all, explain to us, what is lupus?
Lupus is a rare but chronic condition that can cause joint pains, skin rashes, low blood count, and kidney problems. The Lupus Foundation of America estimates that there are at least 1.5 million Americans living with lupus. It's a disease that can come in many forms, and not every patient may have all the manifestations.
Also, they can be different. Lupus is different in patient to patient.
That's right. Some people can have just skin rash and joint pains. Others can come with just kidney problems.
So this is sort of a public relations kind of a week that, is it a week or a month long?
It's a Lupus Day today plus a month long topics.
And you just want people to be aware of lupus because there's maybe some people who have it and don't know it, or what's really the purpose of the month?
You know, I think I actually have to thank you guys for talking about lupus, because it is such a rare condition that many people haven't heard of it. And when diagnosed early and treated appropriately, it can certainly have very good outcomes. In fact, long time ago in the 60s, the mortality rate from lupus used to be 50%. But now with new treatments, advances in care of people with kidney problems, there are 95% of people that will live for more than 15 or 20 years.
What did people used to die of with lupus? Why did they die?
Many times they would die of kidney failure, sometimes infections, and now we know that there is also an increased risk of getting heart disease from lupus. So all of these conditions together would lead to the increased risk of death.
So then lupus is something that is more managed than cured? Is that fair to say?
That's correct. It's unfortunately still incurable, but certainly with good medicines and medical care, it can be kept under control.
Is there any ideas or any research being done toward finding a cure for lupus?
I think there's a lot of exciting work going on trying to find lots of new targets for drug treatment, because what's frustrating about lupus in the last 50 years, or at least until 2011, there had not been a single drug that had been FDA approved for treatment. So there's a lot of exciting research going on trying to find new molecules, and at least in the last year, there are definitely phase 1 and phase 2 trials of 5 to 6 new drugs that are being done.
All right, the most common symptoms that you want people to know about?
Many times people will have joint pains that are worse in the morning with stiffness. They may have skin rashes that get worse in the sun. A lot of people complain of fatigue and just not feeling well. Rarely people can notice protein or foamy urine. So it's important that if you're not feeling well with joint pains, it's better to get it checked out by your doctor.
In both men and women?
That's the peculiar part of lupus. It tends to affect women a little bit more commonly. So for every one man, there are 9 women, but that's not to mean that men get a milder disease. It's just that it is more common, more commonly seen in women.
There's a specific type of rash that affects the face, isn't there, that in many people with lupus?
I'm glad, Dr. Shives, you still remember your medical school diagnosis. Yes, it is called as butterfly rash because it involves the cheeks and the bridge of the nose. So it looks like the wings of a butterfly on somebody's face, and that's why it's called a butterfly rash or a malar rash. Rarely you can have rashes on the hands. Mostly these rashes are on sun-exposed areas, so on the hands, chest, etc., is the places where you'd see them.
Well, Dr. Chaudhary, happy World Lupus Day to you.
I don't know whether to, but thank you, whether I should wish happy Lupus Day, but definitely I'm glad you're talking about it, and a happy Lupus Day to all the patients as well. Thank you. Thanks for being with us,
Dr. Chaudhary. You bet. All right, we'll take a short break, and coming up, we'll talk with urologist and incontinence expert Dr. Dan Elliott, plus myth or matter of fact, it's normal to leak a little urine when you cough or sneeze. Oh. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Dr. Elliott at 507-282-1234 or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us at #MayoClinicRadio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McGray, and this week's guest, a urologist and incontinence expert, Dr. Dan Elliott. Dr. Elliott, welcome back to the show. Always good to have you on, and it's always a popular topic among both men and women.
Yes, it is, and thank you very much for inviting me back.
And I suspect that the main message we want to get out is that you really don't have to live with incontinence.
That is correct. There is almost always an option for dealing with this problem. And with proper counseling, proper evaluation, there's usually something we can do to make this better for individuals.
You may not be able to cure it, but for most people, you can manage it. Is that a fair statement?
That's a very good assessment of the problem. Sometimes we cannot completely eliminate this problem, but we can make it better, improve quality of life, make activity more enjoyable, overall improvement.
I suspect that in your practice, you see so many people with incontinence that you suspect that every older individual is somewhat incontinent. Are there people who are older who aren't incontinent? At least females who have had babies don't have a little bit of leakage of urine.
Absolutely. We do know that there are some traits within families that some individuals are more prone to developing incontinence. Others might not have it as severe, but unfortunately, as the body ages, whether it's be low back pain or bladder problems or shoulder problems, the bladder can wear out. And when it wears out, incontinence develops.
And that's for women. What about for men?
Men is a little bit more difficult situation because for men with the prostate, there can be surgical issues that cause incontinence. That can be a major problem for individuals. But men can also have what's called overactive bladder, which is sudden urgency, frequency, getting up at nighttime. So they also have the worn-out bladder that can affect them as well.
So for a man, it's a couple of reasons, isn't it? The prostate tends to enlarge as you get older, and that can lead to incontinence, or at least a urinary frequency. But then there's also the problem of men who have had their prostate removed, and the incidence of incontinence following prostatectomy is pretty high, isn't it?
That's dependent upon who is doing the surgery, unfortunately. But yes, leakage after prostate surgery can definitely occur. There can be damage to the sphincter muscle. That's what's trying to hold back the urine. Or if the prostate cancer is aggressive and it's grown into the muscle, that can affect it also.
Are you saying that if you have a really good, experienced surgeon, the incidence of incontinence after prostatectomy is very low?
Well, I'd say the data is very impressive. And that doesn't matter what specialty you're in or what surgeon, whether it be ENT, orthopedics, urology. The more the surgeon does, the higher the volume center, the more training that surgeon has, the results are better. And so the leakage is less.
Is the incidence of incontinence following robotic prostatectomy less than routine open prostatectomy?
That is a great question. That goes right back to what I said. If you have a high volume, very well trained open surgeons, that's the old fashioned word for just saying they used incision, They will have great results. If you have a less than ideal trained robotic surgeon, then it's like putting me in an Indy 500 car. Magnificent vehicle, but all that means is I hit a wall going very, very fast. Okay? But if you have a great robotic surgeon, high volume, the results are going to be very good.
The other thing I want to ask you about before we talk specifically about treatments for incontinence and the different types is we see so often on TV advertisements for people who, from attorneys, seeking out people who have had vaginal mesh procedure, either for vaginal prolapse or for incontinence. What's the problem there?
This is a huge problem.
First of all, before we do that,
sure.
So we know what incontinence is because we talked about that. Vaginal prolapse, please explain.
Sure. We're talking two separate processes, though sometimes they're overlapped. Prolapse, obviously, this is just for women. After they've had multiple childbirths, sometimes a hysterectomy, the vaginal wall can weaken and can prolapse, which just means come out.
Fall out.
Okay? Versus incontinence, where there's leakage with coughing, lifting, okay. Those things. Okay, so now, meshes came out roughly 10 or so years ago for prolapse. They cause a significant problem as far as scarring. And that scarring causes pain that frequently we cannot fix. It causes it to extrude out the vagina. Horrible amount of pain with that. And so this has been a major source of problems. And hence the lawyers have gotten involved to sometimes actually help out individuals who have no other source of help.
So what they would do then, you would take this mesh and you would put it under the vagina or under the urethra to support them to prevent prolapse or prevent incontinence.
Now, first of all, I'll correct you because you said the word you, and you is not me.
A lot of people, but not you.
The surgeon.
I do not do it, and no one at Mayo Clinic Rochester has ever put in the meshes for prolapse. We were against it from day one, which is kind of important.
It's like my old friend Dr. Tony Bianco always said, stay one fad behind.
And this is a perfect example of it. The old-fashioned surgeries for prolapse, which I was trained in, you have some stitches that absorb over time. They cost about $3. You put them in, and the results of that were identical to the meshes, which cost about $2,000 or more and did not have the long-term complications. So by Mayo being behind the fad, actually was way ahead of the fad. Multiple other doctors were too at high-volume centers. But these meshes have caused some devastating problems. Any given day, I have an individual come in my office, horrible pelvic pain, they can't walk, they can't lie down, can't stand for a prolonged period of time because of the pulling and the sensation they have. And we don't have a way of fixing that.
You cannot fix it.
No.
Oh.
It's because also long-term with these problems, they start to scar over time. And when that happens, you can go in there and remove it, but the damage is there and the scarring progresses. It's a devastating problem for some of these people.
Wow, too bad. All right, so let's go back and review briefly the symptoms of incontinence so people understand exactly what incontinence is.
Okay, let's break this down. There's two different main types of incontinence. The first one is called overactive bladder or urge incontinence. A sudden, boom, urge, you got to go to the bathroom, you better race there or you're going to leak, and sometimes leak a lot of urine. It can be a little bit less than that as far as just a big sudden urge, but they don't leak, but still it's in the same category. Okay.
So that's urge incontinence.
That's urge incontinence. That's category number one.
Both men and women.
Both men and women.
Okay.
Increases with age. Sometimes some medical conditions like Parkinson's or stroke can increase it. Now, Problem number two, stress incontinence. For men, this is almost exclusively following prostate surgery of some sort. For women, it's childbirth, age, maybe repetitive lifting. And that the symptoms for that for men and women are the same. They're fine if they're sitting down. They're not leaking at all. They go to stand up, and the urine floods on down the leg. Okay, it's kind of like a leaky faucet, just drip, drip, drip. So they're lying down flat at nighttime. They're fine. They do activities. They're leaking. Okay, two separate problems. Both involve leakage, but they're the treatment's completely different.
Myth or matter of fact, a little urine leakage is normal.
When you cough or sneeze.
I'll just say just straight out, is it normal?
Normal
is part of aging?
It's part of aging to a certain degree. No question, you don't see any Major League Baseball players at age 50. There are the body wears out with time.
Okay.
The sphincter muscle is just like your bicep, your legs, anything. So it's not as robust as it once was as individuals age. So it can, a certain bit of leakage can definitely occur.
Can be normal.
Now, is it normal? Yes, it's probably normal, but there's usually something we can do to help.
Okay.
All right. And who can help? Is this something that you would go and talk to your family practitioner about, or would you go straight to a urologist, a specialist like yourself?
I think frequently, as far as the initial evaluation, a family practice doctor, internal medicine is a very good starting point. They can do some basic evaluations, make sure there's no blood in the urine, important things. And if treatment's not progressing well, there's not enough results, then I think it's time to go on to a specialist.
And what type of treatment would they generally prescribe for this problem?
Okay, they first have to make the right diagnosis, overactive bladder or stress. If it's stress incontinence, there could be some exercises or frequently surgery.
Are you thinking Kegel exercises?
Kegel exercises can sometimes help. But if it's overactive bladder, then the next step usually is medications. The big broad term is what's called anticholinergic medications. Oxybutynin, Detrol, Vesicare. You turn on TV, you see these commercials.
Now, tell us again about Kegel or Kegel exercises. Now, Deb Leitner, we've done them with her on the show.
I don't doubt that.
But for some people, they might not have been listening to that program. So explain to us again what that is, because they're good.
It's what you do at a stoplight.
Yeah. I won't have you all go through the Kegel exercises right now, I'll probably explain it just like Dr. Leitner. It's basically just clamping down the pelvis. Like you're trying to prevent urination, okay? The best way or best example I heard is if you're going to the bathroom and somebody opens up the bathroom door or bangs on the bathroom door, the pelvic muscles slam shut. That's what a Kegel exercise is.
Now, the best way to do them, if you're trying to strengthen your pelvic floor muscles, is to hold it for how long and then...
There's no set that's absolute right number. People get kind of fixed on this. It's got to be 10 seconds for 20 times. No.
Got to do your reps.
I am all for you do it as much as you can, for hold it for a good 10, 15 seconds, just trying to build up that. Now, data really shows that it's actually better for overactive bladder than for stress incontinence.
Oh, really?
Absolutely, because with overactive bladder, the bladder's spasming. So if you clamp the pelvic muscles, it sends a signal to the spinal cord to tell the bladder to, hey, stop that. Okay. So for overactive bladder, it's actually better. Stress incontinence is more of a problem where the muscles are worn out, so you can't really build that up too much.
All right, so we were talking about medications, and some of the medications that I think you mentioned or listed had some or have some unpleasant side effects, but now you have a newer medication, right?
Correct. Unfortunately, all medications have side effects. It's naive to think that they don't. They all have them. Some have more than others. The anticholinergic medication, that's that big class of medications for overactive bladder, they all have dry mouth, they all can potentially cause constipation, they can cause dry eyes. Now, most of the time, that's very minor. Good thing about it, it does not interact with any other medications, so it's safe in that perspective. But for some people, that dry mouth is just too much. That's why the new medication called Mirabetriq has come out. It works on a different mechanism, does not have the dry mouth. Unfortunately, it's very expensive right now, so many insurance companies don't cover it.
Mirabetriq. So if someone, if they have difficulty determining whether or not you have urge or stress incontinence, are there some tests that you can do, some sophisticated testing that you can make a precise diagnosis?
absolutely. The most sophisticated study there is a doctor who knows what they're doing. Because by history, the best way to diagnose this is actually to sit down, talk to an individual. It's basically free, and you don't need to do expensive studies. There are some studies in complicated situations, what's called a urodynamics, fancy bladder function. But if the doctor just listens, asks the right questions, and listens, you can make the diagnosis.
Overactive bladder, we've heard about treating that with Botox. Is fact?
Absolutely. I do that a lot. Botox is a treatment that you do after everything else fails. So you try the conservative things, avoiding coffee, getting exercise, losing weight, medication. And then when all that fails, you can go to Botox. Botox is a very easy procedure to do. It's quick. You need to have some light sedation to do it, but it works very well. And 80% of people have failed everything else. We get marker reduction of the symptoms with it.
And how do you do that?
A procedure where an individual is sedated, meaning sleepy under anesthesia. We have a long needle that goes into the bladder. We look with a camera, and we inject it all over the bladder. And in 80% of people, we get benefit, and it lasts 4 to 6 months, so it's not permanent, but on 4 to 6 months on the average.
But you have to be sedated to have it done.
Yes, you do, because you don't want the individual moving when you have a big needle in them.
All right.
That's not a good thing to have.
And now you also have, just quickly mention for us, the surgical options that you have, and most of these you can be done as an outpatient, right?
Yes, the traditional therapy for stress incontinence, I think you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional therapy, the pubovaginal slings, were fairly big surgeries. The meshes came out, which were good, but as I mentioned, had problems. Well, we now have developed at Mayo a new treatment that is completely natural, but also outpatient. So we avoid those long-term problems, but also get the benefit of having it be an outpatient procedure.
We certainly want to talk more about that as time goes on. And I also want to remind our audience that we'll be asking you to join our program after the news at the bottom of the hour. And we have two complimentary copies of the book called Mayo Clinic on Incontinence.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest is an expert on incontinence, Dr. Dan Elliott. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams, and right after that, we'll be taking your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Comments and questions from the website at radio.mayoclinic.org, and your tweets at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. 3 million U.S. kids were in a study about diabetes, and the researchers of that study found the prevalence of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes increased significantly between 2001 and 2009. The researchers say understanding this change is important, and they want to inform clinicians about care that'll be needed for the kids living with diabetes. They say that knowing about the increase may help to prompt other studies designed to figure out why the increase has happened. And now some news about an issue that can happen after hip surgery. An article in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings links some nerve damage after hip surgery to what's called inflammatory neuropathy. It used to be blamed on mechanical factors such as positioning of the patient during surgery or surgical injury of the nerves. This study looked at patients who developed inflammatory neuropathies, and that is where the immune system attacks nerves, leading to weakness and pain. Here's Dr. Nathan Staff.
Some patients who develop nerve damage after hip surgery, that it's not due to mechanical factors. It's really due to an immune reaction or an inflammatory reaction against the nerve. The implications for patients are that because it's an inflammatory mechanism, there may be inflammatory treatments that we can do using things such as steroids, which we used in several of the patients in this study. Other implications are more from a medical legal standpoint.
The good news is if they can identify patients with post-surgical inflammatory neuropathy rather than damage caused by a mechanical process, they may be able to provide treatment to help the pain and improve outcome. How many times have you heard this? Moving is good for your health. Well, a new study published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine shows for women, lack of exercise trumps other known risk factors for heart disease, including being overweight. Now, the researchers say from the age of 30, physical inactivity exerts a greater impact on a woman's lifetime risk of developing heart disease than other well-known risk factors. So the researchers suggest there needs to be a bigger effort to encourage people to exercise. Now, the risk factors they looked at were being overweight, smoking, high blood pressure, and physical activity. And they estimate that if every woman between the ages of 30 and 90 could do moderate exercise 2.5 hours per week, then the lives of thousands of women could be saved each year. They say promoting exercise should be a priority. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know. This is Mayo Clinic Radio. Time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by telephone. The lines are open, 507-282-1234, or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Leave your comment or your question there, or you can always tweet us. Very popular way to get a hold of us. Hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. And by the way, we have two copies of the book called Mayo Clinic on Incontinence. Everything you need to know about the problem. Two of our callers will receive a complimentary copy. 507-282-1234.
I have a very quick moment in Mayo Clinic history for you, Tom.
Perfect.
50 years ago, would you believe it, in 1964, when a postage stamp was just 5 cents, the U.S. Postal Service actually issued a stamp in honor of the Mayo brothers. The centennial seal used in 1964 is the first depiction of practice, education, and research. The practice part being the patient care. That's the three shields that are visually represented in that Mayo Clinic logo.
I have one of those stamps.
Yours? You do?
Yes, I do.
For your stamp collectors out there, it pictures James Earl Fraser's statues of Dr. William and Dr. Charles Mayo in their surgical gowns. Printed in green, the symbolic color of medicine, the stamp also shows the staff of Aesculapius.
Aesculapius, yes.
Aesculapius, okay. That's the symbol of healing. And yeah, most physicians, you have that tattoo on your arm, right?
Well, yes. Yeah, but it's hidden.
It's okay.
I don't want everybody to know.
We put that on our website if you want to see that stamp and Aesculapius.
Yeah.
You can see that. Go to radio.mayoclinic.org.
I suspect every philatelist out there has the Mayo Clinic stamp.
Now, that's got the one snake, or does it got two snakes? What does it have, Dr. Elliott?
Well, the caduceus actually is the one snake, which is the symbol of medicine.
Okay.
The rod of the whatever you just said, that's one snake, and that's how it's a different thing.
So. You knew that, right, Dr. Shines?
Yeah, I got a two-snaker.
It's not that we looked that up during the commercial break at all.
No, not at all.
All right, we have phone calls for to talk about incontinence for Dr. Elliott, 282-1234. Bill is on the line, and Bill, don't hang up because we have a book for you when we're done. Good morning, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Yes, doctor. Sometimes I'll get up two or three times a night, and sometimes four. And I'm wondering if taking over-the-counter medications like Aleve might have something to do with bringing that on. I don't know. I just wonder if over-the-counter medications can actually do that to you.
Hey, let me ask you, Bill. Have you had any surgery on your prostate at all?
No, sir.
Have you been told you have an enlarged prostate?
It's getting that way, but not very big, no.
Okay. Dr. Elliott?
First of all, I think Dr. Shives did a very good job with those first questions. Those are great questions.
I wanted you to have all the information you needed.
I'm not needed here. You're doing a good job. Getting up at nighttime, as individuals age, is very common. The average after age 65 is 2.5 times per night. A certain bit of getting up is normal. Now, as far as what causes it, it's a fancy doctor word called multifactorial. It means a whole bunch of things causing it. Medications like you're talking about, Aleve or naproxen, anti-inflammatories, have no association with causing this. It usually has to do with sleep habits, drinking fluid, anxiety or nervousness, things like that.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Okay, so listen, Bill, I tell you what, wouldn't you tell Bill that maybe he ought to avoid liquids for a certain period of time before he goes to bed and restrict his coffee, tea, and alcohol?
A general rule of thumb is after 4 in the afternoon to start reducing the amount of fluid. By doing that, basically, it's less fluid coming in, less fluid going out.
All right, Bill, there you go. And you'll explain, the book will explain everything that we didn't. Yep. Hang on the line.
Yep.
Thanks,
Audrey.
Bill.
Audrey, we'll get your address and we'll send that out to you. Carol, you get the other book. Good morning, Carol. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. I didn't have a specific question for today. However, I wanted to really thank you guys for covering this topic. I am in my 70s, so I'm with people my age who sometimes this gets to be something we talk about between the ladies. And I think by bringing it to the attention of the general public, it makes us realize that this is just another body part that as we get old, it needs a little bit of attention. And it makes it. We don't need to be embarrassed about talking about things like this.
You bring up. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but you bring up a very good point. There's a lot of individuals who don't know that there's help that's available.
Uh-huh.
So by this show, that brings us an audience that we can bring out some good information. So you bring up a very good point.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, Carol, you and your friends are not alone.
Well, that's it. And so we just don't need to be embarrassed when that's how it is.
Yes, feel free to talk to your doctor. Bring this up. Because a lot of times, doctors, we get busy and we don't actually, well, I do because that's all I do. So, but others, you know, they don't think about this. So bring it up. Talk to your doctor saying, is there something that help that can be provided for me?
And it sounds like there's several options.
Yeah. Thank you, Carol. You hold on the line and we'll send you a copy of the book, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. Jeanette has got a question about patches. Good morning, Jeanette. Go right ahead.
Yes. But what about the Oxytol patches for women? They're 3.9 milligram a day.
Sure. I'm very familiar with them. The reason why these pills or these patches came out, they're the exact same medication, but it's a patch that goes on the skin, and there's fewer side effects with them. So the problem with, well, first of all, they're good. They're safe. They can cause some skin irritation. But the problem is they don't pack much of a wallop. So as far as getting benefit from them, it's quite a lot less than the pills.
Okay. And this new pill you spoke of, that Metacort or something or other?
Let's see, it's called Mirbetriq.
Mirbetriq. It's a tough one. Why the company came up with a name like that is beyond me. Mirbetriq, it's difficult to say and it's difficult to spell.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's called M. Do you have a pen?
I've heard of it.
Okay, it's Mirbetriq.
Mirbetriq.
Riq.
Riq. Are there many serious side effects with that?
That's a very good question. And it's overall fairly safe. However, if you have hypertension, which is high blood pressure, that blood pressure has to be adequately controlled for you to take this medication. So it's important for you to have had a physical exam to make sure that hypertension is not a problem for you.
Okay. What about oxybutin or Daytrol or Vesicare in a very low dose?
Sure. Those are those traditional medications, that big category of what's called anticholinergics. Those you mentioned, oxybutin, Detrol, Vesicare, Enablix, Sanctura, lots of those medications, they all work on the same mechanism as far as calming the bladder down. They all are good, they're safe, but there can be the side effects of the dry mouth and constipation I mentioned earlier.
Thanks for calling, Jeanette.
All right, thank you.
All right, we have a couple of lines open, 507-282-1234, incontinence expert Dr. Dan Elliott. Mirbetriq, you said it's expensive. Do you know how expensive?
The answer to that is very.
Yeah.
Okay, what about herbal remedies?
Okay, well, back to your question. It depends upon insurance coverage. Some insurances, very few, will cover it. Most of the time, they're getting rejected, and I have to write a letter of support for it.
Okay.
But it is a pricey pill.
It's not the first one you'd try.
By no means.
The one that you would use in an individual who had tried all the others and could not tolerate the side effects.
That's correct. When we give, like, the gold standard is what's called oxybutin ER. It's been around forever. It's dirt cheap. About 5 to 10% of people have dry mouth with it. Only a small percentage of those can't tolerate it. Okay, in those individuals, then I'd go with the new one.
Okay.
Okay, so herbal remedies.
Yes.
What are some of them that people use, and do they work?
The answer to your question is, what do they use? A lot of things.
Okay.
Herbal medication has never been shown in a high-quality study to actually have some benefit. Roughly about 30% of people who take medication for bladder symptoms get benefits. So if you give them a placebo, placebo is a fancy word for just saying a sugar pill. Okay, 30% of people get benefit. From herbal medications, 30% of people get benefit. So I have no problem with that. It works for an individual, great. But again, that's not my first line of treatment by any means.
Okay.
All right. How about these tweets?
Yeah. Well, we just got a question in on Twitter about a 16-year-old boy that still is wetting the bed and having trouble with that. What could be the cause of that?
That is a very good question as well. Wetting the bed, this is almost always not a bladder problem.
Sure.
If an individual, no matter what age, is fine during the day, they urinate normally, they don't leak, but only at nighttime, then I know that's not a bladder problem. That is usually a sleep disorder.
Problem.
Okay, so that's the first question we ask. Now, if 24 hours a day they're having a problem, different ball game, the bladder needs to really be evaluated. Unfortunately, this is a common thing we see. We don't have any good treatment for these people. Hmm. I send them to sleep clinics. We have bedwetting alarms. But still, the problem usually persists.
Hmm. Are there, myth or matter of fact, are there some foods that trigger incontinence?
Absolutely, and that's urge incontinence, not the stress incontinence.
Okay.
Stress incontinence is a structural problem. You can eat whatever you want, no problem. However, urgency, very definitely the bladder, just like some people have like hay fever, and they get all out. Well, some people have allergies to the things like coffee, which we're all drinking right now. So maybe in about 10 minutes, we'll have some urgency. But it stimulates the bladder to spasm. Does not cause the problem, but it's like putting gas on the fire.
Okay.
So coffee, high-dose vitamin C, can do it.
Okay.
Citrus foods, anything's kind of acidic can do it.
How about this tweet from Claudia? It says, it's mind over bladder. This is what was said to me by a female urologist. What's that mean?
Okay, first of all, when an individual comes in, we have to evaluate the whole person to try and figure out what the problem is. Sometimes, very definitely, the bladder controls the individual, and they get the slightest urge to go to the bathroom, and they race it. It's because it's Pavlov's dog. They've become conditioned to give in to the bladder. So we try, in a certain subset of patients, to get them involved with bladder retraining to get the brain back in control of the bladder. And with a motivated individual, it can be very successful. But again, that individual has to be appropriately evaluated to know if that's it. And it's not a psychological
problem. What you're saying is that, in a sense, this can be true.
Absolutely, it can.
But unfortunately, Claudia heard it, though, as a psychological issue.
Yes. You have to be very careful how you mention it. And sometimes you can cut the doctor a little bit of slack, because we get misinterpreted all the time. We're like some politicians. No matter what we say, it's going to be wrong.
Everybody does.
But it is not a psychological problem. It's a learned behavior. Remember, everything we do in life is learned. Reading, writing, whatever, driving a car. Same thing with the bladder. The nerves learn how to do this, and so we try and retrain the body.
282-1234. Good morning, Pete. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead with your question.
What's the problem with Sudafed? You know, like if you have a bad cold, take Sudafed, and then you, even though you have an urge to urinate, you can't.
You can't go. Absolutely. You called it.
You're right on.
Sudafed has a double whammy, which usually hits men more so than women. It does two things. Number one, it stimulates or makes the muscles of what's called the bladder neck. That's where the bladder and the prostate join. It makes that area contract down. Number two, it takes away the push of the bladder. So it's two different things in that Sudafed. So men, frequently, they're fine. They pop a Sudafed, and all of a sudden, they cannot urinate. Very, very common thing. So it's basically just a normal fact of what the medication does.
Thanks for calling, Pete.
Better to just suffer with the cold, Pete.
Sometimes, yes.
I want to go back to that psychological piece of a myth or matter of fact list that we have here is psychological stress can make incontinence worse. So is that the other side of that coin?
Yeah, we have to be careful as far as what we're talking about. Psychological stress is different than stress incontinence. So psychological stress, like nervousness, agitation, you're getting ready for a radio show, you're amped up, and that is just, hormones are produced to make you active and wake up. Okay, well, that also makes the bladder wake up, and it makes it spasm down, and that can cause urgency.
Gotcha. 282-1234. Good morning, Lee. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead.
If you've had a sling previously, like 8 years ago, and you're starting to have some stress incontinence, can anything be done?
Absolutely.
All right, so she had the sling. So tell us a little bit what that means.
She had what she's talking about, the sling surgery I mentioned earlier, that's providing support underneath the urethra, the tube you urinate through, for women so that they don't leak urine with activity like walking and coughing things. So when we do these surgeries like the sling, unfortunately with time they can stretch out again. And so it's not uncommon to have recurrent stress incontinence, especially the longer it is. But by all means, something can be done. Now, it can be more tricky, and the surgery has a little bit lower success rate with it. But yes, some things can be done for this.
Do you have to replace the sling, or you just tighten it up a little bit?
Well, we can't do anything with the original sling. We've got to put in a new product to provide extra support. And that gets tricky. I mean, this is what I do all the time. And as far as tensioning this is important, you have to tighten it up a little bit more, but you can't tighten it too much, or the woman won't be able to urinate.
And I suspect it's made more difficult because there's scarring there where the previous surgery was performed.
Absolutely. Think of this. The urethra is only about 3 centimeters or 2 inches long, more or less. And that's why we put the sling. There's going to be scar tissue around it. So the dissection, which is our word for getting in there, our incision, is more difficult. Putting our sling in, it doesn't want to collapse as well. So yeah, it's more difficult surgery.
All right, Lee, we've got a man who can fix it.
Thanks for calling, Lee.
Thank you.
All right, and Colleen has our last question about bedwetting. Go right ahead, Colleen.
Yes, you had spoken a little while ago about an individual who had bedwetting, and you had said that that might be caused by a sleep problem. Could you define what kind of sleep problem that might be?
Yeah, what it is usually, now we have to underline that word usually because it requires appropriate evaluation, but the individual gets in such a deep state of sleep. Now we see this also with individuals who take sleep medication or a lot of alcohol, not implying in your situation that's the situation, but when the person gets in such a deep state of sleep, when their bladder fills up during the night, it sends a signal to the brain, but the brain does not wake up. So subsequently, the bladder says, well, I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to get this urine out. So again, it's a sleep disorder in that the person just does not wake up with appropriate stimulation from the bladder.
Thank you, Colleen. All right. Well, tell us again why patients with incontinence or how patients with incontinence can be helped.
Number one, they've got to recognize that the problem frequently is treatable. Number two, they've got to bring it up to their physician. If they don't say anything, the physician can't magically know there's something going on. Number three, then they got to get the appropriate evaluation. That's the little more difficult part, to know the training of the individual. But with that proper expertise, almost always we're able to do something to improve the situation.
So even if it's a little embarrassing, you should bring it up with your physician.
Talk about it. There's no problem in talking about it.
Certainly, you have behavior modification, you have medications, and you have surgery. Dr. Dan Elliott, thanks so much for being with us. Always great to have you on the program.
Thank you. It was fun.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Next week, we'll talk with Mayo Clinic neurologist and stroke expert, Dr. Robert Brown.
So if today is World Lupus Day and part of World Lupus Month, it is also Stroke Awareness Month.
Is it really?
It is. Well, that's why Dr. Brown is coming in.
Exactly what we're going to talk about. And there is some good news about stroke, and that is that it has dropped to number 4 on the list of diseases that kill Americans. It used to be number 3, and that's good news. But it is not something that we can forget about, because a stroke kills someone every 3 minutes in the United States, and stroke's leading cause of disability worldwide. We'll talk about the warning signs. Remember the FAST acronym, FAST, something everyone should know. We'll review the risk factors. Some of those may surprise you. And we'll talk about the diagnosis. If you think you're having a stroke, how do they find out for sure? How do they determine that for sure? And of course, treatment. And the key there is if you think you're having a stroke, the first thing you got to do is call 911 because they can actually stop a stroke in progress and you can avoid all the complications. Plus, stroke prevention, all that next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. You can access a podcast of today's program there as well as previously aired Mayo Clinic Radio episodes, or go to mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to help you better manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Dan Elliott, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.